In case of a nuclear attack, the protection of records is essential if this country is to carry on its economy.
Aliens, man. George Washington, man. He was in a cult. And the cult was in the aliens, man.
And we appreciate the fact that Steve wants all of the seven mountains of society to be taken over for the Lord. Including government, yes, including government. Family, business, education, and so on and so on.
Welcome to Season 2 of Western Fringe, a podcast about Colorado's weird history. I'm your host, Heidi Beadle. Today, I'm at the University of Denver, which was one of the approximately 44 colleges and universities that conducted research for the CIA's MKUltra project during the 1950s and early 1960s. This season, we're going to be looking at religious institutions and cults in Colorado, and I think the MKUltra research is a good place to start. The whole point of MKUltra was to, quote, develop technological methods for mental coercion to be used in interrogations and for the brainwashing and mind control of human agents in human intelligence operations, according to the book Military Neuroscience and the Coming Age of Neurowarfare by Armin Krishnan. I'll reference this one a bunch today. It has a decent overview of the MKUltra program and cites a number of other authors who have done research on MKUltra. The idea of mind control and brainwashing will be a kind of through line for the stuff we're looking into this season. During the podcast hiatus, I found myself spending a lot of time in evangelical spaces as part of my job as a political reporter for the Colorado Times Recorder. I've been learning about all kinds of wild stuff, like the Seven Mountain Mandate, which posits that all the spheres of influence in society should be under the control of the church, which I guess isn't that different from the aims of the CIA. I won't just be picking on Christians, though. Colorado has been home to a number of New Age movements, occult groups, and straight-up cults, and in a lot of cases, there has been a tragic and serious human toll. Not to do a bad True Detective impression, but religious groups have been instruments of social control since the invention of religion. I am not trying to say this in a judgmental way. Religions often have important social and cultural contexts and functions, but in the modern era, it is easy for bad actors pushing prosperity gospels or political agendas to utilize religious methods for worldly purposes. It's also not a coincidence that the CIA, which looked into mind control with MKUltra, also got really into cults, like the Finders, among others. I guess it goes without saying that the MKUltra experiments were also wildly unethical. Some projects used prisoners, notably at the Vacaville State Prison in California, and patients in mental health facilities. The projects at times involved giving subjects drugs like LSD without their consent, and even worse, there were projects that involved using methods like electroshock therapy, 20 to 40 times a day, to induce amnesia and destroy the personality of subjects. All of that is not even getting into the projects that involved brain implants and electrodes to stimulate specific regions of the brain. MKUltra is one of the most egregious and grotesque human rights abuses orchestrated by a country with a long list of horrifying human rights abuses, and the University of Denver took part in it. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1, Denver Hypno.
Color.
probably won't be a big surprise to learn that the roots of MKUltra and the CIA's research stretch back to Nazi Germany, according to John Marx, author of the 1979 book In Search for the Manchurian Candidate. The Nazis saw mescaline, the hallucinogen present in peyote, which some have said is comparable to LSD and psilocybin, as a truth serum, and regularly administered it to concentration camp inmates during interrogations. This line of research wasn't just a Nazi thing, though. The OSS, the World War II precursor to the CIA, was also conducting experiments on truth drugs, except they use cannabis, which, as a proud Coloradan, I find hilarious. I guess back then people weren't used to hitting 70% THC vape pens to make their weekday trips to Target bearable. Christian's book cites the work of Annie Jacobson, who has written about Roswell, the use of biometric data in Afghanistan, and, relevant to today's discussion, Operation Paperclip, which brought Nazi scientists slash war criminals to the U.S. Most people associate Paperclip with Wernher von Braun and the development of NASA and the U.S. rocket program. Never ask a man his salary, a woman her age, or NASA why there are so many German restaurants in Huntsville, Alabama. But I digress. From Christian's book, after the end of the war, the Americans subsequently seized documents about Nazi drug experiments that were related to the breeding program, Annenerbe. I'm sorry if I mispronounced the German words. The documents were brought to the U.S., where they immediately aroused the interest of American chemical warfare specialists. The U.S. government arranged the transfer of selected Nazi scientists to the U.S. under Project Paperclip, amongst them notorious war criminals such as Hubertus Strughold, who had run the Nazi flight medicine research. An estimated number of 1,800 German scientists were brought to the U.S., where they could continue their wartime research. At least six of them were medical doctors who had conducted unethical human experiments at Dachau. Annie Jacobson argues in her book, Operation Paperclip, that physicians and chemists from Operation Paperclip would work on jointly operated classified programs codenamed Chatter, Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra, and others. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that Nazi science inspired American mind control research years before the interest shifted towards Soviet and Chinese mind control techniques. Speaking of which, the term brainwashing was coined by a guy named Edward Hunter in 1950. Hunter was an OSS veteran paid by the CIA to popularize the idea of brainwashing and to alert the public to the new threat. See also Operation Mockingbird, but again, I digress, again. The CIA was worried about communist brainwashing, and of course we aren't going to let the commies beat us. We can't allow a mind control gap. Literally.
Dr. Strangelove, do we have anything like that in the works?
A moment, please, Mr. President.
The first government foray into mind control drugs after World War II was a Navy program called Project Chatter, which started in 1947, the same spooky year that saw the rise of the national security state, and the rise of UFO sightings, and the Roswell incident, and it was a year after the Thelemic Babylon working that involved L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons, buddies of Colorado Springs sci-fi writer Robert Heinlein. Project Chatter used anabasis aphylla, scopolamine, and mescaline in order to determine their speech-inducing qualities, essentially building off of the work that the Nazis had been doing. But at around the same time, the newly created CIA started Project Bluebird, which experimented with drugs and hypnosis in conjunction with interrogation techniques. In 1951, the CIA started Project Artichoke, which looks to exploit along operational lines scientific methods and knowledge that can be utilized in altering the attitudes, beliefs, thought processes, and behavior patterns of agent personnel. According to Krishnan, several Bluebird Artichoke documents make it clear that the CIA was interested in creating a human robot, or a so-called Manchurian candidate. John Marks argued that the CIA's desire was to find a way to remove the human element, which results in randomness and uncertainty in human intelligence operations. The agency wanted to know whether people can be hypnotically programmed to carry out a task, even against their will and without conscious knowledge, and then made to forget everything about it afterwards. Artichoke experiments included the use of hypnosis and drugs like morphine. A 1952 CIA memorandum stated the program's purpose succinctly as a question to be answered. Can we get control of an individual to the point where he will do our bidding against his will and even against fundamental laws of nature, such as self-preservation? The CIA also wanted to know, can we, in a matter of an hour, 2 hours, one day, etc., induce a hypnotic condition in an unwilling subject that he will perform an act to our benefit? Can we create, by post-hypnotic control, an action opposed to an individual's basic moral principles? Could we seize a subject in the space of an hour or two by post-hypnotic control, have him crash an airplane, wreck a train, etc.? A few documents found by researchers indicate that many of these questions could be answered in the affirmative, although there is indeed no proof that hypnotic mind control has been operationally used. It's also worth noting, though a little out of the scope of this episode, that there was a lot of overlap between MKUltra and the U.S. Biological Weapons Program during the Korean War. Retired psychologist Jeff Kay has written a pretty authoritative account of those connections, which I will link in the show notes. MKUltra officially started in 1953, and according to Kirshnan, the main problem with bluebird artichoke research was that it was too amateurish and lacked scientific validation. In an effort to have a more scientific basis for mind control, DCI Alan Dulles authorized Project MKUltra in 1953. It was thus decided that the CIA's technical service staff, under the direction of Sidney Gottlieb, should outsource the research to universities. In the end, a large number of scientists, about 88 institutions, among them 44 colleges and universities, 15 research foundations, and chemical pharmaceutical companies, 12 hospitals, and 3 prisons in the US, Canada, and the UK contributed to the MKUltra research. Some of the institutions participating significantly in the research were Harvard University, the Allen Memorial Hospital, Tulane University, the University of Maryland, University of Denver, the Vacaville State Prison, and others. Altogether, there were overall 149 sub-projects for MKUltra, which covered a wide spectrum of brain and behavior research. Monies were dispersed using front organizations such as the Human Ecology Society, the Geschichte Foundation, and the National Institutes of Health. There is some controversy over whether these scientists knew they were being used by the CIA. Many would have objected to their work being used for the kinds of horrible things the CIA was using it for. One example is John Lilly, who quit his job with the National Institutes of Health in 1958 so he could go on to give dolphins LSD and hand jobs, research that was funded in part by wealthy and eccentric trans man Reed Erickson. Got a highlight the contributions of our transcestors when I can. Alden Sears, the University of Denver professor who conducted the hypnotism research at the University of Denver, claims he has no idea the CIA was behind his research. He was funded by the Geschichte Fund, named after pathologist Dr. Charles Geschichte, who worked for the CIA on MKUltra, and in 1955, he convinced agency officials to contribute $375,000 in secret funds toward the construction of a new research building at Georgetown University Hospital. Georgetown University is also the alma mater of seemingly everyone but me's favorite trans YouTuber. Just saying. That $375,000 was doubled under the federal matching grant program for hospital construction. Marx cites the CIA in indicating that there was a clear understanding with the Geschichte Foundation that in return for the CIA contribution, he would make sure the agency received use of 1/6 of the beds and total space in the facility for their own hospital safe house, and they would have a ready source of human patients and volunteers for experimental use. And the research program in the building would provide cover for up to 3 CIA staff members. Real cool stuff. In 1977, when the public learned about the existence of MKUltra in as much detail as possible, since in 1972 CIA Director Richard Helms ordered much of the MKUltra documentation destroyed, journalists were able to track down Sears and asked him about his work at the University of Denver in the early 1950s. This article is from the Chicago Sun-Times. Hypnosis study linked to CIA. They just showed up at his door one day with their nondescript names and forgettable faces and an offer of money from a foundation back east. His work, done as a professor at a small Midwest college, was unpublished, and they never did say how they had learned about it. But then, their kind never do. They just seemed to know. They told him they liked the results he had achieved with hypnosis and wondered if he'd be interested in doing 5 years of research in the area if they footed the bill. He said he would be and quit his job, and so began one of the stranger episodes in the annals of the Central Intelligence Agency. In part, the episode is about the movie The Manchurian Candidate, although it predates that film. In the movie, actor Lawrence Harvey is programmed by enemy intelligence agents to kill a presidential candidate on signal and then forget the whole thing, including who told him to pull the trigger. The perfect agent. Harvey's programming is fictional, but the idea behind it is not far from the reality the CIA actually tried to achieve with the help of the professor and a little hypnosis. As head of the psychology department at tiny York College in Nebraska, Alden Sears had enjoyed some startling success in turning poor students into scholars by heightening their learning and recall powers through hypnosis. How far could such results be carried in the clandestine services? One CIA official wondered in a classified memo. How well could a person learn and recall complex written material, such as scientific or defense papers? Could a person under hypnosis fool a lie detector, which the agency uses to screen every applicant for employment? Could a person learn Morse code more quickly under hypnosis? And finally, could hypnosis induce amnesia so a person would forget all he had learned and reported while in a trance? The idea of testing hypnosis possibilities for clandestine operations was put into the hopper along with 148 other schemes the CIA ultimately thought up as part of Project MKUltra, an operation of the 1950s and 60s that was designed to develop a capability to control people's minds through use of drugs, chemicals, germs, and hypnosis. The idea was eventually passed on to a foundation the CIA used as a front to finance research of interest to the agency. The front, the Geschichter Fund for Memorial Research, based in Washington, D.C., then contacted Professor Sears, who maintains today that he thought they were nothing but legitimate. "I never heard the word CIA," he said. "All I know is that I worked for the fund and I turned in my results, and that was it." Was it? The CIA's MKUltra records, released to the Center for National Security Studies, don't entirely jibe with Sears' account. In a censored CIA memo dated May 28, 1954, for example, Sidney Gottlieb, the CIA official who ran MKUltra, wrote, "Mr. Redacted and Redacted, Head, Department of Psychology, University of Redacted, are cleared through top secret and are aware of the real purpose of the project." Though intelligence sources and other means, through intelligence sources and other means, the Chicago Sun-Times has determined that the first deletion refers to Sears, the second to Dr. Donald Hastings, now a professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, which was the third item deleted. Sears admits that he had top secret clearance in the 1950s because he worked at the University of New Mexico on the Manhattan Project, the atom bomb project, in the 1940s. Hastings, too, acknowledged he has cleared top secret because he helped recruit employees for the CIA, not because he had any knowledge of Sears' work. As far as the university knew, as was usually the case with all MKUltra projects, Sears' research was bona fide, listed officially as a study in the use of hypnosis in remedial education, which was the cover title the CIA gave it, according to agency memos. Sears stayed at Minnesota in the psychology department between 1952, when he was sent there by the Geschichter Fund, and 1954, when family health problems forced him to request transfer to a higher altitude. Denver University was chosen, and between the summer of 1954 and May of 1957, Sears continued his work, again as a research fellow, using more than 100 students as guinea pigs, paying them $1 an hour for their time. "It was the biggest damn flop I ever had," he said. "A lie detector doesn't do a damn bit of good if you're hypnotized." A censored memo in CIA files also notes that Sears had one study on subconscious retention of material and ability to deliver same without the subjects knowing and consciously that he had ever that he even had this material, i.e. an unwitting message carrier. The memo noted the need for a biochemical test for determining if a person was really in a hypnotic trance or just faking it, the topic of a study later done at Denver, and Sears suggested the possibilities of hypnotizing unwilling subjects and even those who speak a foreign language not spoken by the hypnotist, such as through use of an audio signal. Another intriguing possibility: can auto-hypnosis be taught so as to be effective in canceling out pain or other stress conditions, i.e. if this can be done, a person could create his own world and be happy in it even though he were actually confined in a very small place which was extremely filthy. In the memo, Sears also noted the need to study hypnosis aided by drugs, but he cautioned this could not be handled in a university situation. Was Sears the dupe of the CIA and the fund of their willing partner? Sears, today a Methodist minister in a small Nebraska town and still active in use of hypnosis, says the CIA's role in his work is news to him. He does admit to having heard the name of MKUltra Chief Gottlieb, but doesn't know where he heard it, and he has no idea how the Geschichter Fund found out about his work, unless maybe his brother, Arthur, told them. Arthur, a retired major in the Army Counterintelligence Corps, says he didn't tell the fund and never heard of Gottlieb. But he did use to ask his brother, Alden, casual questions about how hypnosis might help in intelligence training, which was Arthur's assignment in the CIA. There is, of course, the troublesome detail of a 1954 hypnosis demonstration that Gottlieb, in a memo, says Sears gave to top CIA officials at a Washington, D.C. hospital. Sears admits he did give such a demonstration on three subjects, inducing pain and prompting distant recall of facts. But he says he was told that everyone present at the demonstration, including Gottlieb, was an official of the fund. "I've been reading some of the MKUltra stories in the paper," Sears said. "I don't know what it was or wasn't. At the time, I just wanted to increase the knowledge of hypnosis. I don't care who uses it. I wouldn't have cared if the CIA used it, as long as we can use it for mankind." Well, there you have it. It seems like Sears definitely knew what was going on. And, you know, he definitely knew what was going on when he went to the University of Denver, at least. The University of Denver themselves maintained plausible deniability in this 1977 article from the New York Times. "The chancellor of the University of Denver said today that the school participated in mind control experiments sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency 20 years ago, but did not know at that time of the agency's involvement. Maurice Mitchell said he received a letter from the agency on August 12 informing him that from 1954 to 1957, Alden B. Sears, then a graduate student at the university, conducted the experiments under a grant from the Geschichter Fund for Medical Research, a CIA front. As far as we knew at the time, Geschichter Foundation was just another grant-providing foundation, nothing more," Mr. Mitchell said. He said that under the grant's provisions, Mr. Sears, who may not have known that the experiments were connected to the CIA, was to perform three types of hypnosis and mind control studies. One experiment involved testing whether or not a person could be brainwashed and programmed to do something at a later date. Officials said Mr. Sears left the university in 1957, and his last known address was in Geneva, Nebraska. However, he could not be found. Weird how the New York Times, the famous paper of record, couldn't find Sears, while the Chicago Sun-Times was able to track him down. I was able to find a handful of academic journal articles written by Sears about his hypnosis research, written between 1953 and 1957, while he was working for the CIA at the University of Denver. I am not an expert in psychology or hypnosis, but lucky for you guys, I was able to make the acquaintance of Melvin Marsh, who is a credentialed hypnotist, to talk about the work of Alden Sears and the efficacy of hypnotism as we know and understand it today. Can you kind of give me a rundown of your, like, professional credentials and background with hypnotism?
Oh, my. So currently, sorry for the noise back there. So I have two master's degrees. One of them is actually in aviation, and I was an aerospace psychologist in that area. And I just picked up a master's in experimental psychology. So there's that. I've been an EMT for several years, focusing on psychiatric emergencies. When I was in medical school, because I was in medical school for a while, I fell in love with hypnosis and ended up with a diploma in hypnosis, over 1,000 hypnosis credit hours, which to me is amazing. I run a primarily medical hypnotherapy practice out in Augusta, Georgia. It's after-hours hypnotherapy because, quite frankly, I'm a night owl. So I have training from basically, my list of training is like a who's who of professional, you know, hypnotherapists, especially in the Ericksonian world. So I do tend to focus on medical stuff, but I've also done teamwork, cooperation. Actually, my thesis was on encouraging cooperation. Could hypnosis influence that? I've done some work on learning. Basically, if you name it, I have probably done it at some point or have a certification in it. I have about 15 separate hypnosis certifications.
Gotcha.
So it's a lot. I feel old.
So can you tell me a little bit, like, today in 2022, what are, like, the modern, like, practical or medical or clinical applications for hypnosis?
There are, at the last time I counted, because there's always this, like, running list of what have we been using it for, there were over 400, you know, things that hypnosis can be used for. You know, we are still talking, very, very common. I think we're most famous for smoking. I've done a little bit of smoking cessation. That's not really where my passion is. Weight loss is very common. And a bunch of medical things. Pain management is incredibly common. We've also been used for relaxation, anxiety. It can help with depression, trauma, PTSD. There's some evidence for bipolar, but I'm not comfortable enough to say, yes, we should be using it for bipolar. But you name the situation, it seems like there has been at least some help. It might not be perfect, but there's usually at least something. I don't want to say it's a miracle because I really hate saying anything like that, but it has been doing, there has been an awful lot of things that it has at least helped with. It might not be perfect, but it has helped with. So.
Okay. Can you explain kind of in sort of layman's terms, like what is the mechanism? Like how does hypnotism work? What does it do to the brain? How does it function?
So the way I usually tell people what it's like, oh, that's where I will start, is it is a very intense form of relaxation. It's basically what it is. And what I'm doing is there's this little voice in your head that is, I shouldn't say voice in your head, but there's this little part of your brain that will, they're always scanned for all these things that are coming in. And are saying, okay, that's right, we'll let that filter in. Oh, that's wrong, we'll just ignore that. Sometimes not correct things get in. Now, we do know a few things about hypnosis, about what happens in trance. We do know that if you're familiar with EEGs and brainwaves, we know that that hypnosis, it starts to develop a little bit in the alpha wave, which is a slightly slowing down. We see it a lot in theta, which that's usually where your dreams are, but you're not necessarily dreaming in hypnosis. Hypnosis is not sleep. And we have actually also seen something that's kind of odd that's called theta-gamma coupling, which means your brain waves are going from periods of kind of slow to really, really fast, faster than it usually would be, and alternating that way. That information has been popped up in the literature a couple of times. It's kind of neat. I actually want to study that a little bit more. But we do know at least that happens. Now, the question of it, that a lot of people are not 100% sure how everything works. There has not been a lot of people that have been studying hypnosis as far as research goes with the modern technology, because people really still think that hypnosis is really, really fringe, and it's really not. There is a lot of medical doctors who are bringing in hypnosis into their practice, a lot of psychologists, some medical schools even teach a little bit, very, very light hypnosis. But a lot of people are aware of their clinical stuff, but are still trying to figure out specifically how things work. Like, I know there's one guy who's actually a stage hypnotist who has a theory about some part of the brain that's got to be turning on and off, but so far nobody's been able to find it, mostly because COVID shut down that experiment. So eventually when COVID clears out, he's going to start that experiment again, do some imaging studies and see if he found it. He's kind of interesting because he actually has a degree in experimental psych. He just makes his living mostly as a stage and corporate hypnotist.
What's his name, so people can kind of look this guy up if they want to check
So his name is Anthony Galli. Is it G-A-L-I-E? You can see him on YouTube. He does Hypnotized High School, which is really kind of cool. I just love watching the high school students go down. Somewhere on his channel, he does talk about his theory that he has. And that, like I said, he posted that a little bit before COVID decided to shut down the world.
Gotcha. So can you tell me a little bit about trance states? Because that's a big part of hypnosis, right? So what exactly is the trance state that you enter? Can you explain that a little?
So you can make the argument that basically all of hypnosis is that trance state. Now, there's a lot of discussions over, okay, well, what is trance? Because nobody has ever gotten a good, solid definition of it, because every hypnotist gives something slightly different. But the one thing that we can agree on, it is an altered state of consciousness. And it's usually described as being very, very, calm and a relaxed state. Now, as I said earlier about the EEG, you can actually find when somebody starts going into trance. And the trance state is very interesting because it's not necessary. It's not a situation that it's like sleep. Some people call it sleep, and that's really not even close, because if you are a normal human being, you are going to be very much awake during this process. But there are some different types of trance. Some people will say, like, there's one common way of dividing it is like a downtime trance, which is that intense period, you know, feeling of relaxation, very calming. It's kind of like, feels like meditation a little bit. They're cousins. They're not exactly the same, but they're very related. And then there's this, like, this other type of trance that's called an uptime trance. And that would be if we've ever had any discussions over whether or not you're an athlete or anything, but I do know you do a lot of writing. So when you get into a state and you're just so intensely occupied, maybe you're not necessarily relaxed, but you're very, very focused. You're in, you know, the zone when you're writing your article or whatever you're doing. That would be like an example of an uptime trance. Now, some people are discussed whether there are different levels of trance, like low level trance versus, you know, light trance, medium trance, deep trance. That's very subjective. Like one of the training places I went to had light, medium, and like three stages of deep. Then other places say that there are 1,000 levels of trance. Because it's really hard to estimate exactly where anybody is. Anything would be arbitrary. But at least the uptime, downtime trance makes it allow it to be a little bit more easy to understand.
Gotcha. So one of the things, I'm kind of exploring in this particular season of my podcast is kind of religious environments and cults. And you kind of touched on meditation a little, but are there like ways of entering trance states and like, religious ceremonies? Or, you know, I looked into this group called Landmark for a story a couple of years ago, and they're based on EST, which is based on like Scientology stuff. Are trance states like present in kind of religious experiences and ceremonies and things of that nature? Would that be an accurate description, or am I reaching?
No. You're dead on. A lot of religious rituals and stuff can put people into a positive trance. You know, it can make it a very enjoyable experience. I'm Jewish. I've gone to synagogue. You know, I used to go quite a bit before COVID, and you know, somebody who knows what trance feels like, I will go in and out during the entire hour, 45 minutes, hour service, especially on Friday night. So it's very, it is not uncommon. We'll say that. And some places are very specific in doing that. Sometimes if you're really a trained hypnotist, sometimes you can just listen to some of these pastors. And you can see and feel what they're doing. And some of them are quite accomplished hypnotists, even though they don't even realize that's what they're doing. So yeah, you're on the money.
Okay, interesting. So let's talk a little bit. So Alden Sears, he was part of the MK Ultra, like he was funded by MK Ultra, but he claimed he wasn't aware of it because the CIA was using a front. But he did this hypnotism research in kind of the early 1950s at the University of Denver. And would you feel comfortable kind of broadly giving me your take on the, you know, the papers that I sent you and the work that he was doing?
So, you sent me, I think, like 4 or 5 papers. Mm-hmm. And for the record, I would like to say I did actually ask another friend of mine about the guy, and he said he'd never heard of him. So, except for 4 papers that he happened to find. So the papers, I think, are very traditional for the 50s. In the 50s, the state of hypnosis research wasn't great. we are better now, but they were trying to do something back then. And I'm not entirely sure they would necessarily get published now, because they did have some things that we know are not 100% correct. But for the 50s, it probably as close as we were going to get. Like one of the things that popped up that I know would not be accurate now is he actually in one of the articles, and I don't remember which one, he mentioned some suggestibility or susceptibility scale. I've reached out to a lot of people about this scale, and it was like the husband and something scale, mm-hmm. and I've never met anybody who's actually heard of the scale. At the time, and I don't know when these other scales necessarily came out, but we're more familiar with the Stanford scale, the Harvard scale. More recently, the Elkin scale, which is out of Baylor. Those are the ones that most people nowadays would hear. I looked through basically dozens of hypnosis, but I have no idea about that scale. So I cannot say a thing about that thing. I can say that, some of the stuff he was doing, he was trying to help people. I know was one of them was learn Morse code.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can influence people to learn a little bit better. Now, that isn't necessarily that it means I'm going in and you're going to perfectly memorize Morse code. I'm a ham operator. I don't know Morse code. And I should. I tried. It didn't work very well. Maybe I should have hypnotized myself to do it. But you can, when somebody is having struggles with trying to memorize something or study something, you can, if they really do want to get some help, you can go in and find out kind of what their barriers are, what's going on, and, play around with it a little bit in hypnosis and make it a little bit easier for them to go and study, for example. There was a mention in there, in one of the articles, they said that the hypnosis people found it a little bit, more fascinating to study. Okay, well, depending on if you're going in and your people are bored, you might be able to go in and make it a little bit more interesting for them. So hypnosis can definitely help you a little bit with the memory front. You are not going to learn a foreign language while you sleep, however. I did buy those audio CDs back in the day. I still don't know any of the other languages. That used to be very popular back in the day. But you can use it to influence, to at least improve study habits. So that I can totally get behind. I would kind of like them to do a new study and see if anything still holds or if they can improve the stuff that they did. Because nobody has heard of these things. And the organization that publishes the articles, all the articles that you sent me, is a very well-respected institution. The journal is published by this group called SESH, Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. They're fairly well-respected. So I'm going to assume that whoever's edited the stuff, they knew what they were talking about when they published it. But, But when I reached out to a bunch of other SESH members, because I am a member of that organization, it's a very small organization, they, like I said, weren't really familiar with the work, even though it was in their own journal. So it's kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was like 70 years ago. One of the things that stood out to me in that, he was describing the helping people learn things, and he described the students that were involved in this hypnosis study to try to improve study habits. And he mentioned that they had habits of daydreaming and not being able to focus on something unless it was of interest to them. And today in 2022, I think I would read that as descriptions of ADHD or something along those lines. How do things like neurodivergence affect someone's susceptibility or efficacy in terms of hypnosis?
So there's been a lot of debate and discussion about that. I'm personally have ADHD. I have a diagnosis. I have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder as well. I have never had a problem with anybody that has ADHD or has some type of autism spectrum. I have never had a problem putting them into trance and getting them to do whatever they want. They need to have done. There are other people that are 100% convinced that people with autism can't be hypnotized. People with ADHD can't be hypnotized. One of my certifications is actually in ADHD and hypnosis. So, I live with it, and I've done probably 100 people with one of those two conditions, and I've never had a problem. So, it seems to be very dependent on the hypnotist, because if the hypnotist doesn't know what they're doing, they're not going to hypnotize them anyway.
Gotcha. So also talking about kind of conditions and things, and this kind of ties back to MK Ultra and some of the theories that people have about MK Ultra, but how does something like dissociative identity disorder affect someone's susceptibility to hypnosis?
So most of the evidence that has been presented in the various peer-reviewed journals, DID would make you increased susceptibility. A few others that do tend to increase your susceptibility outside of DID is also post-traumatic stress disorder and various forms of schizophrenia-related disorders. So those are the three big ones that will overwhelmingly tend to increase your susceptibility, because quite frankly, you're already like on the border there and are willing to take in things that might not necessarily 100% be accurate as is. So,
gotcha. And how, MK Ultra, most people, if they know anything about MK Ultra, they know its associations with like LSD and psychedelic drugs. How does the use of like psychedelics or hallucinogens impact or interact with hypnosis as well?
So we strongly recommend you not do any of those things when you come for hypnosis, because the poor hypnotist needs to be able to know what is going on. And let's say you're on LSD and we don't know, and you start freaking out about a giant dragon in the corner of the room, you know, that's gonna throw me off. I don't know if it's gonna throw everybody else off, but you suddenly tell me about that, I'm gonna be like, what on earth? But we really recommend you not be on any of that, because if we're supposed to be, and I hate saying the word in control, because the hypnotist really isn't in control of anybody, but us trying to manage the session and give you the appropriate suggestion, it really helps if we have I don't want to say a blank slate to work with either, but we need to know what's going on. And when you're dealing with some of these drugs, you'll start to hallucinate, which throws our control of the session off, and makes it so that we might not be able to know what we're doing. We've got various other meds that might make you so tired that you fall asleep, that you go right through trance and go to sleep, and then we can't access you anyway because you're completely gone. And I've heard some really weird things about like taking pot and getting hypnotized. So I've heard it all sorts of different ways. The problem is there's just so much stuff that's going on that we just don't deal with it. That's the thing. It's hard to predict how it's going to affect you. Basically, again, anyone or anything, just because of the nature of the meds.
Gotcha. The MK Ultra experiments on hypnosis and psychedelic drugs and all these things, a lot of kind of that one news article that I sent you kind of mentioned, like the Manchurian Candidate and you know, the work of Dave McGowan. I don't know if you've read anything by him, but he's written this book called Program to Kill. And there's this idea, right, that through, you know, MK Ultra or through hypnosis, through the use of like psychedelics, through kind of like brainwashing techniques, right, it would be possible to kind of program someone to commit specific acts of violence, say to, you know, people have mentioned kind of MK Ultra around like the RFK assassination and like Jack Ruby, and to some extent like John Hinckley. What do you think of that suggestion that like using those techniques you could program someone to be like a government assassin?
Let me tell you how many times that I've had people that have popped up with those concerns. And I mean, there's been, first of all, nothing in any literature that has shown that this has, first of all, ever happened in any way, shape, or form. Second of all, just based on what everybody, you know, I shouldn't say everybody, because everybody who's actually in the hypnosis field knows, that would take forever, assuming that it even worked at all. It takes, first of all, a lot of time to brainwash somebody. I don't speak from personal experience. I don't go around brainwashing people. But I do know that that takes a long, that allegedly takes forever. I know what it's like to hypnotize somebody. I know what it's like to hypnotize somebody to do something that they claim that they want to do and how much of a struggle that would be. You're talking, let's assume that it happened. Somebody would have had to take these people, and this would have been 8 or more hours a day for probably a year or more. That's all they did. Just because it's so complicated, so complex, and in all likelihood would probably fail anyway. There have been a lot of cases where people have not through necessarily through hypnosis, but have tried to get people to say that there was somebody else or program them to raise them to think there was somebody else. But a lot of times that doesn't go too well because eventually it just collapses. So I would think that the odds of any of that being real or likely, you're looking at like a million to one odds. I mean, the odds are just so ridiculously unlikely. Nobody has that type of time. The hypnotist would be too tired to deal with it. And at 8 hours a day, let me tell you, if I'm doing hypnosis for 8 hours a day, well, quite frankly, I can't even figure out how to do hypnosis for 8 hours a day straight, because if you get me past 3 hours, I'm starting to fall asleep myself. So I cannot imagine what poor hypnotist would be doing this in the first place. But trying to get somebody to so violate their base structure, because that is what I'm assuming is going on. I'm assuming this is an average Joe who has no particular interest in killing somebody. Trying to get them to forget who they are, program them to do something that's against their value system, that is basically, it's for all practical purposes, completely impossible. There's, like I said, there's been no evidence that we can even break a small bit of ethics, much less something that big of a change. It's just highly unlikely.
And the theory that McGowan kind of proposes, right, is that you're kind of including all those factors. So if you take someone who has like a history of extreme abuse, right, and they've developed dissociative identity disorder, and then, you know, you ply them with like LSD or some kind of psychedelic drug, and then you use these kind of hypnotism techniques, would any of those extenuating factors kind of change the outcome there, or still no?
So somebody who's been majorly abused, yeah, they might be much easier to convince to go abuse somebody else. That's that whole cycle of abuse that we hear about periodically in psychology. But if you're playing somebody with drugs and then trying to give them suggestions There's the thing right there. LSD is kind of a wild drug in and of itself, and it's completely unpredictable. I think that would be your focus there. I think you'd have a better shot if you didn't have any drugs in your system. And then maybe they'd have a small chance, but I think the drugs would be the problem. I mean, even drugs that are called hypnotics, you can't put – it doesn't really work very well if you're also adding hypnosis to them.
Interesting. Okay. So I guess the last thing when I think about hypnosis, can you talk to me a little bit about like false memory syndrome? Because, Sears in like his first article did kind of mention that it was possible, in 1954, they knew that you could make someone remember something that didn't happen. So can you speak to that a bit?
I can speak a little bit about false memory syndrome. Now, it is my understanding that they didn't realize that you actually could do it until like the, 80s and 90s, because Elizabeth Loftus did research in this. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with her, but she's an interesting one. She didn't even use hypnosis, by the way. That's what's even more wild. But Elizabeth Loftus convinced a whole bunch of people that they were lost in a mall when they were like five. And that was a big deal, one of her things was that she could easily, she pretty easily convinced a whole bunch of people that they were lost in a mall. She apparently almost got written up by like the APA for like an ethic violation or something, is my understanding. Don't hold me to that. But in the 50s, I did not think that in the 50s they knew that false memory syndromes was a thing, because when the satanic panic stuff was going on, that you're looking at 80s and 90s there, people were hypnotizing these people. They were looking for like evidence of like satanic cults or whatever, and they were producing comments about satanic cults and remembering these things, and everybody was taking it as basically the gospel fact when all those were put in by the hypnotist. But you also see a lot of stuff in as far as false memory syndrome. These people that are doing these alien abduction things, because we've had that discussion a month ago.
Yeah.
Wow, my time is escaping me. It's only been a couple weeks. The alien abduction thing. A lot of times, the hypnotists are going in looking for it and are producing it. And once you get something locked in there, sometimes it can be a little bit challenging to remove, which is one of the reasons I really want to be careful with what hypnotists out there are doing memory work. But it's my understanding in the 50s, they didn't know anything about that yet. That really only came to light around Elizabeth Loftus's study, and I think that was like in the mid-90s.
So Sears, in that first paragraph of his 1954 study, he says, "These claims have varied from a complete reintegration of the past to the other extreme, that while under hypnosis, the subject fabricates what the hypnotist wants him to say to the neglect of what was actually in the past." So, I mean...
He may have said that, but it wasn't necessary. It was not definitely well known. And in trance, you can say whatever. The question becomes: is when you come out of trance, is that memory still there? Or does it fade? And are you remembering it at all?
Gotcha. Well. That was kind of all the questions I had for you. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about all this stuff.
Oh, well, you know where to find me in case you ever need me again.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad I reached out to you on Twitter a few weeks ago. Oh, my God.
Last month.
I have no concept of time. It's because, like I said, it was July.
Yeah,
I've had a really rough couple of like months. So to me, every day feels like a week. I don't know when anything is anymore. This is also kind of time distortion, which you also get in hypnosis. But I promise you, I'm not in trance right now.
Can you talk a little bit about time distortion? Because Sears mentions that as well, which I find fascinating. Can you explain how time kind of works in hypnotism?
So, So we don't necessarily know how it works. We just know that it happens. And it's really kind of a wild experience, because it seems and that when you put somebody into a trance, it's kind of sometimes a common trick or convincer. I probably should actually use the term convincer, that when they come out, sometimes you say, how long do you think it was? And it's very common for the person to say either something that's way longer than it was or way shorter than it was. I think it's most common to be like a factor of like 3 or something. So it's not like it's this small thing. It's not like, hey, I throw you into trance, how long do you think it's been? And you tell me 7 minutes and it's been 5. Well, that'd be close enough. I'm saying, you know, somebody comes in and saying, oh, it's only been 5 minutes and it's been 45. Or, you know, which would be more than a factor of 3. That would be a very, very long factor. But I've had that happen. And that does happen. It usually is a convincer of trance. It doesn't have to be, and not everybody has time distortion. So, I know I frequently am no longer, when I'm actually in trance myself, I usually do not have time distortion anymore because I'm just so used to it. I'm also now the one that has to keep track of time because I'm usually the person that is hypnotizing others, so I need to know when their time is up. So I set an internal clock. It's like 45 minutes, then start waking up. But when I'm the client, just letting somebody else work on me, you know, all bets are off. Could feel like it's 5 minutes, could feel like it's 2 hours, but it's usually about 45 minutes.
That's really fascinating.
It can be really, really fun, because if you play, if you really want to play around with it and you are very experienced in self-hypnosis, some people will just, and I do know people who do it, will put themselves into trance literally just to distort the time, like feel like, make it go, you know, make it feel like it's going slower or faster, whatever. Like if they're bored, they'll just do time distortion and make it feel like it's going fast, like speed it up. And now it all of a sudden, oh, look, I'm now at the end of this really boring thing. I know a lot of students who want that skill. So,
well, and a lot of people, like one of the things that Sears also brought up was like using hypnosis as like an anesthetic, right? Like not feeling pain or can you, is that a similar phenomenon as time distortion, or can you talk about that a little bit?
Usually the pain control is considered a separate thing. Sometimes it's very helpful to add both of them. Like I had a root canal without any anesthesia, and that was not a great situation because they just refused to give me anesthesia. And you know a little bit about my history, so you can probably guess one of the reasons why. They just did not like people like me, so they chose to not give me anything. So I said, okay, we're going to, I need to get this tooth dealt with. So I went into trance, and I first went over and numbed my tooth myself, or not basically, I numbed my entire mouth, and then I purposely was basically effectively sped up time. So it only felt like 10 minutes that they were going to my mouth when it was really, I don't remember how long it was. It was like 40 minutes. It was a bit. But yeah, so those are two technically separate things, but you can work them together. And time and pain management really is great, let me tell you.
Interesting.
That's very hot.
You had mentioned earlier that it's being used more by like the medical profession. Can you like, is it just for kind of like root canals or like low intensity procedures or what kind of things do they use this for medically today?
Doctors have been using some form of hypnosis for a couple of centuries. It just never got major. There was a few people that were James Braid was doing some medical work and was doing like pain control for some of his surgeries and stuff like that. So some of the things that I have seen done for with hypnosis by medical doctors or that are requests, the most common one is some type of pain thing, like childbirth. I know a lot of people who did hypnosis for having kids, right? and basically brought their discomfort, shall we say, to basically nothing. They didn't even realize that they had a kid, which I think was pretty cool. You see root canals. There are a few people that are using it for various forms of surgery. So that they don't have to use as much drugs, or maybe don't have to use any. It depends. But those things are all very common. There has been some work about how to convince your body to basically fight off, like increase your immune system. And there is, you know, there's at least some evidence to suggest that it does help that. That needs more data. Is not nearly as well established as stuff like pain management, but I have a certification in that too. Actually, that and as well as HIV specific. So, you know, there have been people that have tried using it to strengthen muscles, which is really cool, because, and I'll tell you a little bit of the study, and I can't remember the author and date, so forgive me. But there was this these people that actually these weren't necessarily sick people. These were athletes, all right. So they took a bunch of athletes and they divided it into groups. So group one went off and I want to say it was basketball, and they practiced however many, you know, however long it was, maybe 30 minutes a day, an hour a day, whatever it was. They took one group that they did not have. They just sat there. And they visualized themselves. They basically visualized themselves scoring baskets or doing whatever they were doing. And then you had this other group that just basically didn't do anything. The group that basically, you know, was meditating and visualizing themselves did almost as well as the group that was actually practicing. So people are using this to try to, you know, say that, okay, well, it looks like you might be able to improve your muscles, even if you can't necessarily get up and do a whole lot. Maybe something else is going on and you just simply cannot move. But visualizing yourself being able to perform these actions might actually be helping you, you know, be able to walk faster. But, you know, let's say you had an injury and you maybe can't walk. Maybe getting, you know, it's almost as good as maybe almost as good as the physical therapy that maybe you couldn't get because you're that weak. So maybe make fewer times you have to go to physical therapy because you basically go and you're already, you know, doing better than you should be, realistically. I have a friend who just had a nasty operation, and I'm going to actually offer him you know, some ways of trying maybe. Because right now he's not standing for anything, but I'm scared he's going to waste away a little bit. So I'm actually going to offer if he wants any of these techniques too, so he can hopefully walk out of the hospital and spend less time in that wheelchair of his. But yeah, so those are a lot of. I mean, it's really kind of interesting all the stuff that it can be used for. There's just so many things, and you name it, somebody has tried it. So it's really kind of cool.
Wow.
And they're trying to use some hypnosis work. Actually, I find it's interesting for trans people, because transgender people will tend to have lower self-esteem, and, you know, to help make things a little bit better so they can transition or whatever they want to do. So there's some of that too.
So, you know, talking about MK Ultra, you kind of already are in sort of a dark place, but have people like used hypnotism for like conversion therapy purposes that you know of?
they have certainly tried, and it has pretty much never worked. So that's what I have actually heard of multiple people that have tried doing conversion therapy, and I've actually been asked if I do a conversion therapy, and I'm sitting here going, when they actually asked me that, I said, so you're talking and you're asking a gay transgender person if they do conversion therapy? That's just offensive. But I do know people that they used to try that. I'm actually supposed to be writing up a thing about uses of hypnosis in the LGBT community. The only things I can find so far, or almost the only things I can find so far, involve conversion therapy attempts. And they have pretty much not worked. Because if that's not exactly something that tends to be a choice. I mean, that's pretty ingrained. I mean, it might, you know, you might want to say, oh yeah, it's working, but if you go back to, you know, doing, you know, things before, you know, the conversion therapy, you know, you might, you know, you then can say, well, I guess it really didn't work. So, and I think more, if anything, it's probably more classical conditioning than anything when they were trying to do some of this conversion therapy and it had nothing to do with hypnosis. But then you're just possibly giving somebody a phobia of doing anything. Like there was this one kid, this little boy said they were female, starting to identify as female. They did some conversion therapy on this poor kid. And because it looked like he was going to grow up to be a she. And they ended up terrorizing this kid with pink and unicorns. So now, you know, that was more classical conditioning than hypnosis. But they did claim that was hypnosis too. But that wasn't. That was classical. Mostly classical conditioning and operant conditioning. Actually, probably more operant than classical. But it was a little bit of both.
And that's the stuff that Skinner was working on?
Let's see. I don't think that was Skinner did operant conditioning.
Yeah.
But I do not think he was necessarily involved in the. I don't think he was involved in the little young trans kid.
I just meant in general. That's Skinner's work is known for like the conditioning stuff.
Yeah. They tortured this poor kid. There was you name the psychological trick they were trying to do it. Operant conditioning, punishing for some things, rewarding for other things. There were some classical things that every time a certain thing happened, this other thing happened. I'm like, this kid, I'm surprised. If this kid survived, I'm surprised. But some people also claim that they were also using hypnosis on this kid. I was like, I don't care what y'all say. This kid is screwed up, and it probably has nothing to do with anything other than what you just did to this poor kid.
Wow.
Especially when there was a good chance the kid was probably just going to grow out, you know, probably going to grow out of it, but who would know? The kid was like 4.
Wow.
You know? And so what? A 4-year-old who likes pink and unicorns. I have bigger fish to fry than that, than to worry about that.
Yeah. Initially, MKUltra ended in 1963. A subsequent and similar program, MKSearch, was launched in 1964 and ended in 1972. Officially, MKUltra was unsuccessful.
There are those who claim that MKUltra never really ended, and a 2016 New York Times story detailed how Guantanamo Bay detainees were tortured using a combination of stress positions, sleep deprivation, isolation, and medications like Haldol, an antipsychotic. Sounds a lot like MKUltra to me, but what do I know? Next week, I'll be in Colorado Springs, where we'll talk about James Dobson and America's premier faith-based initiative, Focus on the Family. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe or tell a friend or whatever it is you do with podcasts. You can connect with us on Twitter at Western Fringe, WSTRN Fringe, or drop us a line at westernfringe@protonmail.com. This episode was brought to you by Odds and Ends Emporium, a woman-owned toy and gift shop located at the Ivy Wild School in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Visit oddsandendsemporium.com to see their wide selection of unique toys and gifts. Until next time.